Since 2001, average growth in Africa has been higher than the global average, and a lot of commentators pointing out that the old narrative no longer holds. That growth experience has actually been in place since 1995. We've seen accelerated growth in the region. It becomes even more meaningful if we look at the medium-term forecasts. I think many have focused on the fact that if we do look at the forecasts between now to 2015, 2016, with the exceptions of China, India, Vietnam, if we're looking at a list of the top 10 fastest-growing economies globally, most of those countries are sub-Saharan African economies. In that sense, the perceptions of Africa seem to have changed very meaningfully. And at Standard Chartered, we ourselves have spoken about the 7% club, a grouping of countries. What's special about 7%? Any economy growing at that rate, sustaining it for a decade, will effectively see a doubling in economic size every decade. And that's club, so-called 7% club, again is dominated by sub-Saharan African economies. But the problem is that it's very easy for an economy, or easy enough for any economy, to grow for a sustained period of time without necessarily having that growth being transformational, without necessarily delivering any structural change. And perhaps the point that hit home was the publication of the Nigerian Poverty Report earlier this year. There has been, of course, a lot of enthusiasm about Nigeria's headline rates of growth. We all know that much of that growth in recent years has been driven by the non-oil sector rather than just the oil sector. Even so, it appears that no matter what indicator of poverty we're looking at, relative poverty, absolute poverty, the poverty indicators have actually worsened despite the growth. So this is clearly an issue that does need a lot more examination. What is it that's been driving African growth? And what are the things that make us more comfortable with the suggestion that this is actually transformational? That it's not just going to be a period of growth that lasts a decade or a little bit more than a decade because we've seen elevated commodity prices and that we won't succumb to the usual cycles, the cycles that we've seen in the past in Africa. Well, maybe an examination of the reasons that people think lie behind Africa's recent growth experience. Why did Africa suddenly start to outperform, on average, the global growth average? What was responsible for this pickup in economic growth and economic performance in the region? A lot of it had to do with improved governance. Many commentators have spoken about how, on average, we've seen a change in governance in a lot of countries, perhaps a more open embrace of democracy or multi-party democracy. Still a lot of thoughts about how meaningful that might be. But that seems to have been sufficient to make governments more accountable to the demands of the electorate. Demands for greater macroeconomic stability. Of course, we all know that we saw improved policy making, narrower fiscal deficits in Africa, especially in the run-up to the global economic crisis, perhaps less so now this side of the crisis, and that resulted in single-digit inflation. Prior to the food and fuel price shock of 2008, sub-Saharan Africa had had a number of years where it was achieving single-digit inflation. Interest rates had come down. A lot of frontier markets had opened themselves to international investment. Investors started to pay attention to the growth prospects in Africa. And meaningfully, we started to see a lot more activity in terms of financial inclusion, in terms of the rise of financial intermediation in the region. To our minds, this is a point that probably doesn't receive enough focus. What was it that led to this growth boom in Africa? A lot of people will focus on resources. We'll look at what was changing within African economies themselves. And it's difficult to ignore what was happening with financial intermediation. Granted, more focused on some economies rather than all economies generally. But the median level of private sector credit in real terms in Africa saw a doubling in the last decade. That suggests to us that it is meaningful, that there has been some evidence of transformation. The problem, as we said, is that this hasn't necessarily been widespread. We see very little evidence of convergence taking place in African economies. When we do our growth simulations and try to predict what Africa looks like 10, 20, 30 years down the line, if we're looking at the top 10 economies in Africa, Maybe at some point, Nigeria, because of its growth trajectory, is going to become a larger economy than South Africa. But otherwise, the top 10 looks pretty much the way it looks now. There is very little, if any, evidence that the smaller economies are growing faster, that much faster, to be able to catch up with the bigger economies. That kind of convergence just isn't happening in Africa. We need to look more carefully at what has actually driven growth in the region. For a lot of external commentators, there's a tendency to see it all as part of the resource boom that the global economy has experienced. And of course, Africa is a resource-rich region, so it's benefiting. That would seem to suggest that the growth that we see might be more transitory, in place for as long as the resource boom is in place, and it goes as soon as we see a collapse in commodity prices. Well, for us, the encouraging evidence is when you actually look at a disaggregation of African growth. Yes, there's been some impact off the resource boom on fiscal balances, but to assume that governments have been spending that resource wealth efficiently and in a meaningful, transformative way might be assuming a little bit too much. The real delta in African growth, what has made a difference to GDP, has been rising rates of private sector consumption, private consumption that we've seen over time. This has been matched to some extent by rising levels of both public and private sector investment. If we're looking at the trade contribution to GDP, actually net exports, more often than not, take away from overall GDP growth rather than add to GDP growth. So there's still a question mark about how much Africa has been benefiting just from the direct impact of the resource boom. The evidence seems to indicate that for much of the region, the oil importing countries especially, the surprise is that they've been able to grow despite this very negative impact on GDP off net exports. It's something that has taken away rather than added to African growth. We're fairly convinced that the growth in Africa can't be explained by commodities alone, and there are a number of studies that we could look to try to prove this. If we plot terms of trade developments against trend GDP growth, real GDP growth in the region, actually, when you take into account all sub-Saharan African economies, there's very little correlation. It's not negative, it's not positive. There just doesn't seem to be a robust relationship. What we have noted is that on average, there has been a step up in the growth rate of most African economies. And that applies whether or not they're resource rich, oil importing or oil exporting. Yes, we all know that in recent years, the oil exporters have experienced very strong growth. But if you were to take a step back, actually all economies in Africa are experiencing some level of higher growth. Perhaps the most conclusive evidence is what we've seen with some studies indicating that for the region as a whole, poverty rates have been falling. Now, we know that sub-Saharan Africa has experienced resource booms in the past. This hasn't always managed to feed into declining poverty rates. High GDP growth driven just by commodities isn't necessarily going to do anything transformational in terms of declining poverty rates. And that suggests to us that there is something deeper at work in African economies, that when we look at the rise in private sector consumption, when we look at the reach of financial intermediation, the greater evidence of financial inclusion, the technological change perhaps that we've seen with the adoption of mobile phones and other technological change, that there is evidence of this deeper growth experience in Africa. But we also need to look, because we know that no region globally has ever managed to sustain GDP growth without seeing a rise in investment. We also need to look at the kind of space that's being created for the scaling up of investment in future years. And that should provide us with some guidance on whether we are going to see more of this transformational growth or whether there are risks to this story. Now, this is unfortunately an area where a lot of the narrative on Africa probably needs to be updated. People have perhaps done so much to say, actually, African economies have been growing. Unfortunately, they fall into a narrative that's probably 10 years old when they talk about improved fiscal policy in Africa. What we did see during the global economic crisis was a large number of sub-Saharan African countries putting in place counter-cyclical policy, which necessarily meant expanding their fiscal deficits, as a means of dealing with the crisis. And it worked. For the first time in maybe the last 50 years, there was a severe global economic downturn, and the impact on Africa does not seem to have been too long-lasting. Yes, African growth decelerated, but it's bounced back, and in most instances, we're seeing headline rates of growth that are back to pre-crisis trends. The problem is what it's done in terms of fiscal policy, where, with the exceptions of some resource economies where resources still dominate overall tax receipts, fiscal revenue, we still see fiscal deficits that are much wider than they were prior to the crisis. So we've seen the closure of those deficits in places like Angola, in places like Botswana. In fact, even amongst the resource economies, they tend to be the exceptions rather than the rule. The problem is that much of the rest of the region, having seen an expansion in fiscal policy, is struggling to try to contain spending, to try to close those deficits again. Once governments start spending more, it's very difficult to try to roll that back simply because the cycle moves on. Another question that needs to be asked is in terms of the affordability of all of this. Where are we seeing a meaningful increase in revenue collection as a percentage of GDP in Africa? Where are we seeing evidence of that transformative change? Ghana, to some extent, after having rebased its GDP and found that its revenue to GDP ratios were very low, has put in a real effort to try to raise revenue. But at the same time, spending has increased very meaningfully, along with the country becoming an oil producer for the first time, and so it's still running a deficit overall. South Africa, in fact, is probably the one major economy that we see where there is a real effort at raising that revenue collection ratio once again. But South Africa's weak overall growth doesn't necessarily instill much confidence that this is going to be hugely transformative. And the worrying thing is we're not seeing this step up in revenue collection almost anywhere else within the frontier African space, certainly. Then there's the issue of rising debt ratios, because we are here talking about how much more investment is going to be possible. Can African economies match the kind of elevated savings and investment rates that we saw in Asia, the kind of savings and investment rates that were so closely correlated with Asia's economic success? The theory is that if economies are seeing fast enough GDP growth, even nominal GDP growth, then the debt ratios shouldn't necessarily be problematic. Countries should find some space to be able to increase spending on infrastructure, and if there's a little bit more nominal debt, that's okay because GDP grows fast enough for the overall debt to GDP ratio not to be a concern. The actual evidence is a little bit more worrying, and that is that debt ratios have generally been increasing across the region. Of course, we can say Africa isn't Europe, we're nowhere near 60%, so this isn't a disaster. But we do need to look at the capacity to be able to service those debt burdens, especially in cyclical downturns. With the kind of interest rate volatility that we've seen in Africa recently, in two of the economies with perhaps the most developed domestic debt markets, Nigeria and Kenya, we saw at one point a complete seizing up of the domestic debt market. These are, by African standards, liquid, large domestic debt markets. But such was the scale of the interest rate volatility that in Kenya, it became very difficult for the authorities to issue any new debt for a while. The worrying thing is that even in Ghana, growing in real terms at 14.4% last year, even in a Kenya where nominal GDP growth would of course have received a great inflationary boost, the debt ratios have been worsening, they haven't been improving. And this is a concern when we look at the ability to create the space for scaled up investment in the future. Let's talk a little bit about fiscal financial intermediation and how it's impacted by the kind of interest rate volatility that we see. First of all, a few stylized facts about financial intermediation. Yes, the encouraging point seems to be that there's a lot more financial inclusion. We have seen meaningful declines in the rate of financial exclusion. But comparing Africa to other regions, private sector credit as a percentage of GDP, probably about 22% in Africa, maybe 10 percentage points higher at least in most Asian economies, there's still some way to go. We also need to look very carefully at the kind of credit that's extended and what it's being used for. The growth experience of other countries tells us that if you see a lot of credit being made available for consumption alone, it's not going to be transformative of growth. You'll get the cyclical upswing in consumption. You're not going to see anything structural necessarily changing in the economy. But if you see credit being made available to businesses for more productive purposes, then yes, you would expect it to be more transformational. Now, we did say that in real terms, the median private sector credit for Africa has doubled in the last decade. So we're certainly making progress, but we need to look very carefully at the sectors that that credit is being directed to. There are still lots of issues, lots of hurdles to financial intermediation in Africa. The very short-term nature of the liabilities, the short-term nature of the loans, the fact that there is very little maturity transformation going on, long-term lending, still more the exception than the norm, and perhaps also looking at the sectors that receive the credit. We know that most Africans, by population, are involved in agriculture in some way. Agriculture dominates African GDP. What is the percentage of the equivalent percentage of GDP of the amount of aggregate bank lending to agriculture in Africa? A recent World Bank report suggests that it's less than half of a percentage point. Clearly not good enough. So things that would need to be watched in terms of, yes, we've seen a positive start in terms of macroeconomic stabilization, but as the experiences of East African economies last year and Nigeria and other economies have shown us, you can't always take that stabilization for granted. There is still a lot more volatility in exchange rates and interest rates that can create a difficult backdrop for really scaling up the provision of credit, especially longer term, to the more productive sectors of the economy. A lot of African firms, for the moment, still very much dependent on retained earnings rather than bank credit to finance what they do. And this is something that we would like to see changing to be more certain that the growth experience we're seeing in Africa is more transformative. So I'll wrap up now. What does the evidence suggest? Very encouragingly, there's no ignoring the fact that the exciting headline rates of growth are increasingly going to be coming from sub-Saharan Africa in the future. But it's probably still a little bit too early to be able to say conclusively that this is transformational. Yes, we do see evidence that one or two aspects of it could well be transformational, but is it sufficiently transformational? Where does it leave Africa compared to other regions? There's a lot of work that's still needed to look at whether African countries can follow the export-driven growth experience of Asian economies. Maybe it's another model that needs to be created for African growth. We shouldn't be under any illusions about the reforms that are still needed. There isn't really any basis for complacency regarding African growth. Headline rates of growth alone, as we know, are probably not good enough. A few points that probably need to be focused on. Investment, which we've mentioned, where are the surpluses being created to create that space for investment? Debt levels. Africa has very low debt levels, moderate debt levels, following especially the recent experience of debt relief. But where are we seeing the meaningful structural change in economies that are going to keep those debt levels low even as these economies continue to grow? Is there enough space being created for the investment, still keeping debt levels under control? The strength of institutions, we could spend a long time talking about that. Human capital development, an indicator that we shouldn't lose sight of at all. And productivity gains in agriculture. These are all areas where we think a lot more focus is needed to be able to say meaningfully whether the growth in Africa underway at the moment, as encouraging as it is, whether it's more transformational rather than just transitory.
Thank you. Nazia, thank you very much. Let's move on straight away to Alec. Alex?
Well, Joel may violently disagree, but after that bravura presentation, I'm rather tempted to say let's just go straight to questions, because that was really terrific. What I certainly can do is I can put away the notes I've culled from a great friend of mine who's just been touring China, selling the Africa story, because I think Razia has really put the big picture tremendously well, and I disagree with almost nothing of it at all. Well, so what I think I will do, which may be more helpful in a way, is to deliver something of a confession that helps to put in context the sort of Africa booming, Africa rising story that has at long last been picked up all over the place. And my thinking on this stems actually from a conversation I had just last night with Thomas, who's helped us sort of get this great occasion together, and we were talking about the sort of curious turncoat phenomenon of being a dedicated Africa follower. And this phenomenon roughly goes as follows. 10-plus years ago, if you wanted to retain a belief in Africa's economic prospects and the sub-Saharan region's sort of long-term trajectory, you really needed considerable faith. And I can proudly say that I was, back in the 90s, sometimes naive, but by and large committed part-time member of this grouping. You have sitting before you, between Joel and Alex, someone who boldly in the mid-1990s came up with the idea of a book on Africa's Renaissance. And I was sort of buoyed up by having just spent time in South Africa covering the end of apartheid, and sort of been caught up in Thabo Mbeki's vision of an African Renaissance, and, you know, like others, put two and two together and made sort of six. And so there was, you know, Museveni's New Age, and then there was sort of Assayas, and all the, you know, and we thought, fantastic, yes, we've got a thesis here. And of course, Mobutu had just fallen. And then even as I sat in Shepherd's Bush taking time off from the newspaper I was then working for, writing this, Eritrea and Ethiopia went to war, Rwanda invaded the Congo again, Zimbabwe really headed into a sort of particularly awful spiral, and I think I was sort of about two-thirds of the way through my draft when The Economist came up with its famous or infamous cover on, what was it, the failed continent? Or, yeah, thank you, hopeless continent. Anyway, I'm still teased by some friends for what resulted, because they accused me basically of writing a deeply gloomy book that ends up saying, but the future is bright, and basing my optimism on one or two very young entrepreneurial figures who were sort of running Coke stalls in outer reaches of Kisangani or something. And in fact, last weekend, I was asked about that very young man who was running a Coke stall in Kisangani, and said, oh, so how is he doing then? Anyway, so you might have thought I'd have been sounding the trumpets two or three years ago, when finally management consultancies, businesses, the media started sort of latching onto the Africa booming story as encapsulated by that McKinsey report a couple of years ago, around the time of the World Cup in South Africa, talking about the sort of roaring lion economies and so on. Well, initially, I was sort of overjoyed and thought, yes, at long last. But then, of course, back to my conversation with Thomas, a couple of factors come into play. One is that sort of once bitten and twice shy, you know, if you're kind of journey, sort of, oh, you know, have we been down this road before, talking about renaissances. And then there's this sort of rather more irritating syndrome in the specialist media circles, which is once your favourite subject gets picked up by the mainstream media, you immediately start changing tack on the grounds, oh, they're dramatically simplifying it, and far more complicated than that to talk of, you know, this region of, you know, all these different countries, and it's just sort of ludicrous to sort of talk about all this. And that's broadly what has happened in the last year or so. I mean, a number of dear friends of mine who know far more about Africa, you know, the economy of sub-Saharan Africa and the sort of fiscal outlook than I do, have suddenly become markedly more sceptical than they were a decade ago, when they felt they were lone voices. Well, here's the confession. I'm something of a double turncoat, because I've been through that phase and come out the other side. And a year ago, I was at one of these Africa Rising dinners, which was hosted by Kofi Annan, and he'd just given a sort of customarily thoughtful speech. But frankly, the tone of the questions at the end and the interventions from lots of business bigwigs and so on was so rah-rah, you know, sort of talk of Singapore and Geneva and Sweden, all these sort of words thrown around as the sort of symbols of what's happening in Africa, that I was then asked to intervene, and I said, well, hang on a moment, let's not get carried away. What about all the obvious caveats? And then some of these aforementioned business people leapt down my throat and said, you know, I'm just sort of a doom-laden skeptic and so on. Well, I still think I was basically right in my specific questions and skepticism of the sort of ultimate rah-rah narrative. Some of my points were very articulately put by Razia earlier. For example, one of the sort of favourite tropes is the middle class. It's like India, isn't it? It's India's middle class just 2 or 3 years away. And you think, well, yes, there is a great middle class growth story in sub-Saharan Africa, but for all the reasons that everyone probably here know better than I do, you know, it's an incredibly split middle class. It's sort of lots of little tiny middle classes all over the place. It's not like saying you can suddenly tap the market in Mumbai or whatever. Leaving aside all the other differences in the sort of Indian analogy, and then there are all the bottlenecks, etc. But as I said, I am a double turncoat because I think overall I was over hasty to sort of try and put this new vision in a different context, because clearly something irrevocable has happened, and that is the critical point. I mean, we are right to be cautious. It's completely wrong to get sort of, you know, rapturous about the situation, but equally it is very wrong to suggest this is all hot air. And I'm just going to give two or three pointers on what's happened in the last decade, and then a couple of very brief conclusions about the future, and then hand over to Joel. The two recent personal pointers. One, the editor of the FT has just spent 10 days travelling around West Africa. Well, so what, you might say, or at least why not? Well, quite right to ask those questions, but actually, you know, if you are the editor of the FT and you know that you're readers are fundamentally interested in the health of the US economy, the Chinese economy, and the Eurozone economy, one might think that 10 days is a bit of a luxury for a part of the world which really commands a very, very small share of the economic pie. But this does reflect something. This reflects his, my, and many others' conversations with people in the US and in Europe, and of course, and then continental Europe in London. There are serious investors who are now thinking this is really interesting, and what do I need to know about this? Second, little personal point. Last night, I found myself sitting in the members bar of one of these sort of very old oak-panelled Pall Mall clubs, talking to a sort of veteran visitor to Africa, to sub-Saharan Africa, about the region. And I should say it was not the sort of classic place of 2 decades ago, namely the Travellers Club, where those sort of conversations were with sort of doughty old spies and whatever, who would be sort of telling you about the latest coup attempt or the sort of Mark Thatcher-esque folly. This man was talking about the new frontier funds. He'd just flown in from New York, and he was talking about serious interest in frontier funds as a sort of new class, and how various sub-Saharan African stories fitted into this. He was also talking about the South African mining indaba, which has now become, this is an annual event in February in Cape Town. Well, you might think, well, who wouldn't want to go to Cape Town in February? Quite right. But it is also the place now to go if you want to know what's going on in mining in sub-Saharan Africa, and indeed in other parts of the world, but particularly in the rest of Africa. Well, as a something of a sort of South African groupie, having done 2 terms as a correspondent there, I find it slightly frustrating that South Africa itself isn't making more of the Indaba for its you know, for its sort of own needs. But nonetheless, you know, these are both sort of both pointers of massive renewed interest. So the trends. There are the caveats for all the fact that it is, as I think, a huge moment for the continent. Look at Walmart's investment in Massmart and so on. We still see the stories about coups in world news pages of newspapers, and I personally, we may come on to this in the questions, think they are right to be covered. Look at the depressing news from Sudan in breaking in the last 24 hours or so. So, you know, right to question the Pollyanna-ish talk. We've recently done some research in the FT on Angola, one of the great growth stories, but of course it's a pretty bleak story. Angola, it's all about offshore oil, and it has no real bearing on what is happening in the rest of Angola. I spent several weeks there a year or so ago and was actually hugely impressed by one of my colleagues who managed to do far more in the last week or so than I ever managed to do in terms of cracking open that story. The trends. Two things I'd like to focus on. One, China in the last decade. Controversially, you may think, I'm going to say China's involvement has on balance been immensely good for the continent. Am I in favour of the hollowing out of industry, the textile industry? No, not really. Am I in favour of the abuse of African workforces? No, of course not. Do I think, you know, that we should, you know, the government should turn a blind eye to human rights abuses? No, ludicrous. And it's encouraging to see in one or two cases African governments pushing back. But two key things came out of this whole Chinese engagement with Africa. One, it sort of woke up the West, roused the West, reignited interest, and made them think that there is something of a competition going on. That's a great thing. I mean, I haven't talked about India, Brazil, but interest in big outside players in what's happening in the region is broadly terrifically good thing, and I think China's encouraged that. It has also, through its infrastructure projects, had a serious impact in a number of countries. And again, I know some of the roads aren't very good quality, some of the railways aren't very good quality, et cetera, but I would still actually say that some of their infrastructure projects have made a huge transformative effect on the continent. That was macro trend number one. Number two, it's slightly more ephemeral. At last, there is a sort of focus on some of the problems that have infuriated business people for so many years. Now, many of them are still there. We know what they are. Let me just focus on one of them. A year ago, I was in Tanzania, and I was right on that sort of southern border region, which abuts, I think I'm right in saying, Malawi, Zimbabwe, and even possibly, could it be Zambia as well? Anyway, there's sort of basically four countries practically that sort of come together. Does that? And it was sort of immensely frustrating because in that area of southern Tanzania, they had a huge bumper harvest, primarily thanks to a really good agricultural initiative, part funded by the Gates Foundation. But, you know, bumper crops. Just across the border, it wasn't starvation, but there was a serious shortage of basic staple foods. But it made no sense to get them. Well, it was almost impossible because of all the tariffs and duties and bureaucratic delays to get them across. And also, it just wasn't cost efficient for these small farmers to do it. Nor was it indeed actually cost efficient to get their stuff to the far north of Tanzania, which also needed it badly. So they had bumper crops, great success, and a lot of it was just left, just. And eventually rotted and went to waste. What am I saying here? So plus un change. Yes, except that the Gates Foundation, the Tanzanian government, Kofi Annan, and others are all. So we're all sort of focusing on this and thinking, right, this cannot happen again next year. What are we going to do about this? And I don't think it will happen again next year. Now, that's just one tiny example of a far broader phenomenon that cannot be just changed by a few well-intentioned, powerful people. But I do think that, by and large, it's okay to say that many more governments are now focusing on some of the pressing issues, even if They're not focusing on many of the other ones they should be focusing on, etc., etc., etc. Conclusions, a long-term point and a medium-term point in terms of building on the growth and making it sustainable and so on. First, the long-term governance. It does remain essential. I mean, it's very tempting for business, I understand why, to just focus on what they do and say, you know, this is a transformative moment and so on. But I'm with Kofi Annan on this. He's perfectly clear that that for all the reformist moves in all sorts of sectors and so on, ultimately the only way the region as a whole or in parts is really going to take off is when it has accountable democratic government. And again, I'm sure we can dispute this. Maybe we will later on. But you know, the macro picture is as we all know, is good. But the micro picture is less good. And here I just briefly touch on South Africa. It's far too easy to sort of get depressed about South Africa from London because the headlines are sort of discouraging about the ANC and so on. And I'm not a doomster about South Africa at all. And the many brilliant things that have been done in the last decade or so. I mean, the tax collection story, as Resi said, is sort of extraordinary, etc., etc. But you know, the ANC remains infuriating on some levels. As I tell friends in the ANC, when, you know, think of the mining industry for a sec. It's not so much the Julius Malema story and the threat, supposed threat to nationalise the mines and so on, which matters. It's more the utter inefficiency of the government. And you speak to miners, and they just tear their hair out, not about, you know, the idea that suddenly they're going to lose everything because it's going to be President Malema, but just to get a mining licence approved and all this sort of stuff is just maddening and far harder than in many other countries. So governments, that's not quite, that's a broader issue than democracy, but it fits into governance. Medium term, even a simpler point in terms of Africa's prospects. I mean, fundamentally, as long as you believe that the Eurozone is not going to blow up the world and that China isn't going to come to a grinding halt, it's hard to come up with a good reason for this narrative to sort of fundamentally change. And I don't think either of those scenarios is likely. So you have to be an optimist. That's it.
Ali, thank you very much. I have to say, I've never seen Joel writing so quickly. Pages and pages.
Uh-oh.
Just have a really sore...
Joel, I've always been an admirer.
It's obviously his training at the FT that...
Yes.
Joel, over to you.
Yeah. Yes, well, you revealed that I am previously of the parish. So, look, I don't know whether I'm a turncoat... So I don't know which way I'm facing, but somehow I find myself in between, sort of not sort of physically, but between sort of Razia and Alec, and I was at that sort of said dinner with Kofi Annan.
You were. You were one of the people that jumped down my throat.
Started haranguing you, but. I just want to sort of say, as the sort of discussant, in terms of the comments that have been made, I mean, I don't think there's really sort of anything one can take away from Razia's sort of presentation, especially given her sort of forte in this field. Except to sort of maybe, I mean, she mentioned some points which I thought I could reflect on. One, you know, she talked about the debt levels and the surpluses, and I think those are very, very... important questions that have to be addressed. But she also talked about two further points at the end, which are sort of the human capital development and agriculture. And I think, for instance, in terms of the presentations this morning, those are two things that haven't yet been actually focused on. One of the things that has led, I suppose, in some ways to this narrative of the new growing Africa, and you have to get worried when things like Sunday Times magazine cover is sort of focusing on this, on Africa. You have to think what's going on. But there's been a huge growth in sort of tertiary education since the 80s, which in turn has led to the demand that Razia was talking about for sort of for certain products, as you have this so-called middle class. Now, it may be in bits, as Alec was saying. However, it has led to sort of the need for modern financing. So you have the mortgages and the financial facilities, health, housing. So, you know, so it's a factor, I think, that perhaps needs to be looked at in terms of the narrative if you're going to look at the continent. Then the other thing, which is agriculture, which is, I think, slightly more worrying, because that is really where the USP is, as they would say, for Africa, but it has not received as much attention, perhaps, as it should do. And in fact, and neither has it received the financing and the sort of the infrastructure that actually could sort of go a long way. And the models that could be looked at, say, for instance, America in the 19th century and other parts of the world. And that is something that I think actually is a great, great deficit, because you travel around the continent as much as I do, and that is something that is lagging in terms of really where they should be concentrating. And everybody wants to industrialize, and everybody wants to sort of be like sort of the next China or whatever. However, very little attention is being paid to what's actually before them. And in actual fact, the fact that you need food, you need to be able to at least, and that will be the engine of exporting, and therefore the engine of growth for the economies. So that is perhaps something that also needs to be sort of looked at. So just picking up from those two points, and I mean, Alec talked about sort of the doomsayers and then the positive things, and now we don't know where we are exactly in terms of those who were there first. I think there is no changing of the narrative, but the point that Alec mentioned about governance is so very critical. If there's anything that I keep being asked by sort of particularly financial institutions, you know, it's not, they'll say to you, yes, we understand the macroeconomics, yes, we understand the figures are all good. However, what about the change of government? What will happen? So in other words, it is actually sort of, in many ways, investment is holding back, and Razia did talk about the need for that sustainable investment. But some of that, and or rather quite a lot of that, is being held back because there isn't a clear path to succession, a clear path for peaceful change. In spite of the sort of developments we've seen, and there are very few military governments on the African continent now, what we still don't have is, we have very few Zambias, for instance, where you can change a government, and we have very few Ghanas. And I mean, I was in Ghana until earlier this week. And, you know, I mean, on the one hand, it's great that the election is on, but of course, the problem is also you can't see a minister now for dust, because, of course, everybody's busy electioneering. So if you go to the finance ministry or the oil ministry, you can't actually see anybody because everybody's too. But at the very least, there is the reason for that is that each side feels they really have to have a go to beat the other, so that there is this democracy that has at least given people the opportunity to sort of say, well, this is how we want to be governed. So until that sort of that picture is still very, very small in Africa as a continent, and the number of investment prospects that it's hurting is really sort of quite large. Most businesses want to know that if I put in 5, 10, 20 million, will it be safe in 5 years? Nobody's investing just for 12 months. They want to know 5, 10 years, 15 years, what will happen. And so, and then, of course, there's the point about the uneven growth. And you talked about Angola. And I don't know how many heard sort of this morning's sort of BBC World Today program when we're talking about the number of Porsche outlets in Luanda. You see, I mean, that is the new thing, and I mean, it's the celebration of Porsche, and you know, of course, the opening of the Porsche outlet in Lagos a few weeks ago was a big thing, and you know, it was celebrated. There was TV cameras or whatever, and sort of same with the second one in Luanda that's happening that's happened this week. Now, the thing is that in some ways that is used as the emblem for growth. But in actual fact, with a product that is $100,000, exactly, when there is no water, you sort of, you know, in fact, next to the building, where, never mind in the next village, but in next to the building, is that sort of uneven growth that is happening. So that there is a rush to show that we on the continent are very much sort of like the West. We have the accoutrements and you know, and the symbols of this development, as it were. So even sort of, I mean, you need hotels, but what kind of hotels are you getting? You're getting the high-end hotels because, of course, you must show that you have Sheraton, you must have a Hilton Deluxe, you must have a, you know. So that is the uneven growth that one is speaking to. I'm not saying that those things shouldn't be there. However, I think too much attention, particularly of governments, is being focused on those things rather than the fact that you need sort of perhaps things slightly lowered down and to bring up the population as a whole. And the reason for that is very much because there is still this influence from those investors in those particular type of businesses swaying, and they thinking that if you don't have this, then you won't be developed, and therefore nobody will come to your country. You need at least 10 Mercedes outlets. You need, you know, the Rolls Royce and the Bentley outlet. You know, not only you need to have Jack Barclay sort of in your high street. Otherwise, no business person is going to come. So that is something that is really very much a feature, and in a way, it speaks to the fact that there isn't that democracy and that really hasn't yet taken root right down. I think, and a sort of final sort of point I would make in terms of the presentations is that not enough was sort of made, perhaps, of media and information. Now, it isn't because I'm previous of the parish, but I'm just saying that unless people are informed and given that critical information that enables them to sort of comment on their leadership or comment on projects, then it's very, very difficult. And I think governments have found a way of saying that we have a free media, but then controlling that media through the back door, either through the starvation of advertising, because in many cases governments tend to still be the main advertisers, or in some ways in sort of subtle sort of controls about not being invited to certain things. And this is, and this goes right across not just the political space but also to the sort of business sector. So actually what you get is a skewed way of looking at a country, whereas you could usually do a sort of survey and look at a particular country, say in Europe or whatever, and at least garner from a rich diversity of media as to what exactly is going on. That actually is not a very good source in the African context, because it won't actually tell you what the real story is. And when people ask me, how come you're always on planes and, you know, you're here, there and everywhere, and that's because I cannot sit in London and be able to sort of talk to people and be able to get that information, because what you will get is not the true picture. And that goes for whether it's the political field, and that goes for data. And at the end of the day, that is the kind of information that anybody wanting to make an investment, anybody wanting to go into Africa wants and needs, because that's the only way they'll be able to make a true assessment. Last point, you know, I think Asia is very much a sort of model that needs to be looked at by many of the African countries. Africa is nowhere near where Asia was in 1982, especially in terms of how many people they were throwing into the various sectors to be able to be educated and therefore come back and then be able to turn out. I mean, I spent a lot of time in Malaysia and Singapore and those kind of countries, and it's nowhere near, and that is 30 years on. So until we get to that point where you can then get that critical mass and in the various sectors, in many ways it has to be a focused program in the way that you focus on infrastructure, education, and then onto in terms of the macroeconomic picture. And unless you get that, I don't think you're going to be able to sort of really. I mean, you will get. There won't be a turning back, but you will not get the so-called takeoff we used to speak about in economic theory. Okay.